This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us.
Website. There's the contact page in my website, and I get the emails like right away, you know. So if anyone ever wants to talk to me, they can just directly reach out to me through that way. That's the best mode for me, you know.
You heard it there first, folks. As we just hit the old record, we've had a pretty awesome pre-chat, I gotta say. I am Matt Stranick. Some of you probably from my classes like to call me Dr. Matt. Just don't call me late for dinner. It really messes with my metabolism, quite frankly. And this is the AdNonTech show, but I mean, really, I guess I would have to say that this is in specific, initially anyway, meant for the Keanu College students in English 104. Introduction to criticism, literary criticism, which I've had the privilege to teach for the past couple months. And in doing so, I've had the real opportunity to bring in various authors and various, literary practitioners through, the various websites and interweb interfaces and apps and every other dang thing. This conversation is something that I've been looking forward to for a while, and it's because Chris and I have just been in touch back and forth through Instagram messages, and we're both busy people, him more so than I am, if you can believe that nonsense. And so, again, just really glad to have Chris Bowes from Kamloops, Shikwetmek, Kamloops, B.C., and here we are to talk about. We've had Chris before. I've had Chris before. Chris has been had before on the music show with his excellent musical composition, his awesome group, Horse Funeral Band, Horse Funeral, as the case may be, where he is currently actually devoting a lot of his creative time and energy. And so I would just say be sure to check out that music interview from a few months ago because. I enjoyed that, Chris. I mean, I think just the fact we're talking again now kind of speaks to that a bit. And so just thanks a lot for being here, man. Thanks for your willingness to even be part of this.
Yeah, no sweat. Always happy to be a part. Always happy to help and do what I can, you know.
Yeah, well, and absolutely. And so I'm not going to be cutting the whole thing and the initial point about from the Camtasia as to Chris is willing and, in fact, overtly encouraging engagement with whoever happens to be checking out this podcast. This asynchronous lecture, as we're going to call it, for the purposes of my classes this week. Definitely within the show notes, the sort of blog posting, if you will, that goes along with this, all of those details are going to be up because for me, I think, this whole piece where you can kind of reach out to people through some of these social media sites. I mean, on the one hand, you can say, wow, social media has really done a lot to diminish and hollow out a lot of our culture. But I mean, on the other hand, you can sort of reach out to people in other areas, other fields of endeavor, and even people who might not necessarily you think would respond sometimes kind of cycle back to you with some willingness to engage, right? And I just think that that could be, potentially a cool thing. So, again, I just really want to start here, Chris, with apart from even above and beyond kind of referring people to be sure to check out the various websites. And where we talked before about music, and I was sort of asking you, you know, in that conversation, where you sort of came from your original sort of musical interest. And you kind of talked about how, you know, your dad kind of led you to some, you know, kind of butt rock kind of LPs, you know, your Sabbath and, you know, that kind of, you know, early metal, some of that early hard rock stuff. Yeah. I guess I wonder, in terms of a literature, you know, kind of perspective, I mean, were books or newspapers or magazines or whatever kind of part of your daily world? Do you have a particular awareness or recollection of that? Or, I mean, how did you get into kind of the literature aspect of your practice, bro?
It started in high school. I probably started writing poetry in like grade 10 or 11, I think grade 11 actually. And I just was going through, you know, a tough time in life, you know, growing up indigenous and poor is, you know, it's a trip. So I didn't have a safe place. And so I often just stayed indoors at the public library or indoors in classes. I just was kind of closing myself off a bit, trying to stay safe. So I'd write poems and I'd do art during lunch hours for about half a year. And then I started getting over it and getting back into, you know, the normal high school bullshit world. But I had a good teacher named Mrs. Cannon. And this was at NORCAM in Kamloops. Awesome. She encouraged me to keep writing, and she gave me a book of Leonard Cohen's, and who else? She gave me another book. Maybe it was Irving Layton. I can't remember. And just encouraged me. She's like, oh, your voice kind of sounds like this guy, and gave me a Leonard Cohen book. I was like, what? And I read it, and I was just like, whoa, this is cool. And I devoured his poetry and Irving Layton's poetry, and then started finding others, right? Other poets and other authors that I liked. And just, of course, playing music, you got to write lyrics, you got to write songs. So I started music when I was about the same age, 16. And I was always the guy who did everything, book shows, gigs, band practices, studios, like everything. I'm a real DIY guy. You know, and so, yeah, that's where it started. And so, one thing leads into another, like you said earlier, you know, the poetry went into songs, the songs went into albums, albums need art. So I started doing art for the albums and our touring for T-shirts and stuff like that, merch. So it's just kind of all encompassing in my life. And it has been since I was 16. It's basically when I started this whole thing. So, yeah. And still here, still going, you know.
That is awesome on a number of levels. And what I really appreciate sort of about the initial impetus for that, right, is kind of the need to stay safe, the need to stay indoors, right, the need to kind of just prioritize your wellness against what may, again, right, I mean, for anybody who has had the experience of being poor or poverty stricken, I mean, I don't know, I identify kind of as lower middle class, which isn't anybody's idea of real poverty. But at the same time, I mean, I know what it's like to just kind of hang around broke, kind of waiting for the day to go by, you know, hopefully as uneventfully as you can, for instance. Right. So.
And NORCAM was a tough school, man. There was fights all the time. I was in fights. You know, I've been in fights since I was in elementary school, for God's sakes, because I often was the only indigenous kid, like in the 70s. You know, we lived all over the place because welfare was after my mom, trying to take me away. She was only 16 when she had me. And so, of course, in the 70s, 1970,
yes,
they were coming down hard. So we were always one step ahead of welfare.
Oh, man.
We went all the way across to Halifax, you know, Victoria to Halifax. Yeah, so.
Gosh.
And every city, every small town, we were on the run. It was crazy. And so, yeah, I learned how to fight at a very young age, unfortunately.
Practical skill, given the circumstances, I got to say, to be honest. I mean,
yeah.
You draw your attention and your skill development to the circumstances at hand, right? And so there you go, man. That's
It was fight or get beaten up. And I think around that time, I had just gotten kind of tired of it. And was just like, I'm just gonna hide out and go to the library at lunch and read or write or do art. And then it just slowly became a safe way for me to express myself. And then I found out I liked it. It was fun. I still write, you know, not every day. I'm one of those writers that's slow. You know, I kind of only do it when it needs to happen, I guess, which is kind of strange. I'm not like one of those. I'm not a Richard Van Camp. I'm not a Gary Goffredson where I got to crank out stuff like all the time. Like in the last 15 years, 20 years, I've only had 4 or 5 books. And in like the last month, Gary Goffredson's probably had 5. I'm just joking. But that guy cranks crazy. I don't know how he does it. Like I just can't fathom it. It's unreal.
I consider that sort of level of output that you describe sort of something akin to like with Stephen King. I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of at that level. I mean, I've been sort of bringing that to my classes, right? Because we are now at this point talking about the short story, right? So I'm going to definitely get my night shift because those stories. And so,
great,
you know, I put up adaptations and stuff. And I mean, again, some of these younger students haven't necessarily encountered Stephen King a whole
lot. Yeah.
And so I'm just like, here's a guy who has been writing a book a year since he was 16, and he's in his 70s now. And most of them have published, and every year, there's a lot of years where he just publishes more than one book. And it's just, he literally gets up in the morning and just goes to his office for 12 hours, and then there's the rest of his day. And again, kudos to those who can sort of throw themselves into that. From my standpoint, anything that keeps me in front of a screen for more than a couple of hours, just kind of, I got to get away from it in order to my own mental well-being, I suppose.
For sure.
It sort of requires me to disengage from the stuff.
I haven't had that. I had that around 2003. We were very poor. Me and my girlfriend, we were having a kid. And I was like, I don't know what the hell to do. So I just wrote 5 books in that year because I was cranking it out. Like I'd get up 5 in the morning and I'd write till 3, spend a couple hours reviewing what I wrote, you know, spend time with her. And then, usually around 8 or 9, I'd get back into it for a couple hours, and I was dedicated, and I really enjoyed it. I should send some to you. One got
published. I'd really love to see it, man. I would be very, very, very deeply interested to see that stuff, to be honest.
One got published, and it was called Somewhere in This Inferno by Thetis Books. It was an indigenous publishing house, but I think it's defunct at the moment.
Okay.
And it's based out of the Anelkin Center in Penticton. And they were the first to really publish Indigenous authors. They had an anthology every year or every couple of years called Gatherings. Okay. If you can find them, man, buy them. Because that's where I first got published, around that time.
And then
they published a book. I might have been published earlier, but every Indigenous writer that's still going today.
Yes.
Everyone got their start there. Richard Van Camp, Gary Goffredson, me, Richard Wagamese, probably, you know, we all got our start in that book, in those anthologies, and they're great. Ah,
so this is the kind of thing where the value of the interview is already becoming apparent to me, because I knew that if you and I sort of got the chance to just kind of get rolling here, that we could definitely have an awesome conversation. Because quite frankly, we're pals on Instagram and Facebook. I think of you as a friend. I mean, I think we've developed a really good rapport here, bro. I think we got a lot of similarities and interests and a lot of overlap, you know, just in terms
of
what we like and why, right? And love that all-important Gen X demographic, which, you know, I tell my students, I've literally said this in class, Gen X is the greatest generation, and I won't even hear any arguments about it. I can't, because it's indisputably true. Exactly. And so, you know, when you're talking about your musical consciousness, where you sort of had that first, you know, the resonance of the early metal kind of making its way to you. And at the same time, right, you have this nascent sort of musical interest overlapping with writers that you're sort of encountering and experiencing as you sort of develop as a human, picking up books as you tend to do. So, I mean, just generally, bro, if I can ask, in terms, you definitely given a lot of credit to poetry here, which as you ought to. we'll get into some more personal anecdotes. I have bought a book of poetry from this man in the parking lot of a 7-Eleven in Lower Sahara with cash, okay, through an Instagram message. And if that doesn't sort of make it a literary connection that is legit, I'm just going to eat my Iron Maiden t-shirt is what I would do. So, you know, not to bring out the colorful anecdotes to get in the way of the conversation, but I'm just saying, you know, it's sort of like when you recognize somebody of a similar sensibility, you go, okay, there's something here to speak to. And so I guess I just wonder now, because you have, you know, devoted so much of your practice and energy into the poetry endeavor, I mean, was prose or fiction or those sorts of narratives part of your repertoire? Is it something you've tried? Is it something you've dabbled in or not? I'm legitimately curious.
In 03, I did a lot of prose and nonfiction.
Okay.
I called it sort of like Richard Van Camp helped me get my first book deal with Thetis, right? Because he was.
Gosh.
Yeah, he was heavily attached.
That's awesome.
Yeah. He was heavily attached to Thetis and the Anoukin Center. He was a student there, and then he was an instructor there. And then I randomly heard that a girl told me when I was at university, geez, in 2000? 2003, I went back to finish a couple courses or something. I can't remember. Anyway, some girl told me at university that her sister was Richard Van Camp's wife. And I was like, what? And I was self-publishing these little chapbooks at the time. From about 96 to 03, I was self-publishing little tiny chapbooks, all different kinds, hundreds.
And bro, I mean, that whole aspect of your practice, the whole self-publishing by hand, I mean, again, I think really that's something where, like, the Gen X people who are really the last people to remember the world before the internet, before sort of the digital onslaught, I mean, that was like a legit way of getting your thing to people, right? I mean,
totally.
It still is, but it carried a lot more significance because the physical media was going to be probably the only way you could even encounter that stuff. So,
exactly.
Like, that whole punk DIY kind of, you know, staple together a magazine where you write these favorite records and stuff. I mean, I saw a lot of that in terms of literature, right? I mean, the literary zine / you know, cardboard stock, poor paper quality, you know, kind of the self-published chapbook is a serious phenomenon in Canadian letters. Canadian lit would not be what it is without that stuff. And I appreciate you highlighting that.
Well, it got me my deal because I gave her a chapbook called God Hates Us All. And I was like, get this into Richard's hands. And then so I didn't hear anything for a couple of months. And then I got this random email. And he's like, meet me at the Tim Hortons in Sahali tomorrow at like 6:30. So me and my girlfriend went and... he was there and it was so cool. Like, he's like, bro, this is fucking the shit, man. You got to get published. I'm going to get you a book deal. And he did, you know. Within 6 months, I think I had a book deal with Thetis Books. And you know, they sent me some money, put me on, published the book. We had to change the title from God Hates Us All to, what was it? Somewhere in This Inferno. And he called it mystic or magical shamanistic nonfiction, creative nonfiction is what he called it.
That is cool, man. That first blush with having your work kind of reach a public at a somewhat elevated level from what you'd experienced before. I mean, that's a very rewarding aspect of anybody who's involved in a creative endeavor, right? Your first kind of contact with, you know, sort of a wider audience in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been incredibly rewarding and incredibly cool. So, I mean, was that just for the one, the contract? Was it under a term just for the one book, or did you sort of then proceed to work with them on other projects?
No, it was just for the one book, but I'll never forget. Me and my girlfriend were sitting overlooking across the street from Aberdeen Mall, overlooking the city and the industrial park below. We're just sitting there, and I had my letter, my acceptance letter, and my check.
Yeah.
And I put on the Datsuns Sitting Pretty. And I we both had an earplug in, and we opened it, and we were like, yeah, fuck, we made it. This is it. And it really, Richard changed my life, man, for the better. And
well, that's awesome. And
he helped me get going, really. I owe him everything.
And see, again, this is where I really feel like sort of speaking to individual writers about their craft and about their influences. Because, like, again, where I've spoken with a few different kind of people with different approaches to books and writing and life, what it's the among the common denominators, it seems to be just being really enthusiastic about what's in front of you in the first place, right? Being really enthusiastic about the music that's already there, being really enthusiastic about, you know, certain kinds of writers, and then just sort of wanting to be able to contribute at that level, right? Sort of wanting to engage with those people in some way. That's kind of how it's been for me. And, you know, I've sort of taken that through now the perspective of kind of reaching out to people within the context to be an educator. And again, I've been sort of bringing forward as much as I can in this class, people who are really making a go of it at the independent levels of the art world as much as I can. Because again, for, you know, everybody who's like Margaret Atwood or, you know, like one of these sort of legacy or legendary practitioners, right? People who just kind of, you know, sort of, you know, they catch a certain headwind within their career and they sort of operate at this kind of upper cultural level where, you know, you sort of get name brand recognition or whatnot. Totally. But then you sort of have the whole wide middle in between like that and, you know, where the real culture happens to be. And the real culture, in my opinion, is a lot of people just sort of pounding the pavement, making the gigs, you know, having art as a foundational creative aspect of your ongoing life, right?
Yeah.
And so, as you say, in terms of a literary endeavor, maybe you don't sort of, you know, focus on that particular output necessarily all the time. But I mean, there's other things at play, and you can't really separate any aspect of it from the other aspect of it without sort of diminishing the whole. I mean, is that kind of like, I know I'm just kind of talking overly here like a teacher and shit, but I mean, does that kind of resonate for you, bro? Or
Yeah. Like I wrote in Shatekin, which is fiction.
Okay.
My third or fourth book, and that was published by Battery Opera Books. And that's about my time working back on the reserve in 2016
as a researcher.
Yeah, I had a contract for my band, my Indian band, to do research. You know, land claim stuff, cultural stuff, whatever.
And awesome. So
I turned it into a book, like an indigenous.
What was the angle? What was the sort of narrative kind of approach on that, if I can ask?
First person. And then I had another part that was more, I guess, omniscient.
Okay.
And I called it indigenous horror comedy fiction. And I roast my chief in that book, and I roast the council, and God, it was so fun. And it was really, 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 really fun. But here's the thing is I write poetry, but I also do prose.
Yeah.
Prose is more storytelling. And I write fiction short stories. Like, I've got 12 horror, indigenous horror comedy stories. You know,
that is dope. That whole genre. I just feel like Netflix executives, if you're looking to pick up a show, you know, you got like your, I mean, to me, I mean, I would watch that, man. That sounds dope. You're kind of taking it. So, I mean, when you talk about sort of finding your own format, when you're sort of looking around at something that gives you, I mean, I've been trying to communicate to people, like, you really got to entertain yourself first. You got to be your own best audience. Because if you're not enjoying the shit, it's not going to come off to anybody else at all. And so you want to just maybe, you know, comedy, indigenous horror. I would, if you could speak to that more broadly, my friend, I'd be curious, I think.
So it's, I'm kind of taking some of the old tropes because our land has been so friggin' desecrated, mining, forestry, you know, just colonialism. So I kind of take some of these tropes where, you know, the miners going out into the woods to this place and the Indians warn them, no, don't go there, you know, we don't even go there. And of course they ignore it and they go and calamity happens. Some of it's, I inject humor into everything. You know, the humor is from an indigenous standpoint and the horror happens to the other people, right? But it's all indigenous. It's all land-based horror. Because we have so many different, I would say, deities in our culture that have been dormant for a long time. And I know a lot of traditional stories, so I'm bringing them back and I'm making them get some revenge, I guess, some closure on this sort of situation. So I'm hoping to get that published. You know, it takes a long time, like from the day you hand your manuscript into a publisher to the time when it's bound and you get a box for yourself and then it's out there in the world distributed. It takes a year, at least a year, because it's got to get edited. Battery opera books, because my stories are so like plays, that he gets a dramaturge to help him with editing. And then, so there's two or three people that go through the book, and then it's got to get the layout and the design. And he always likes art in my books, so I always have to buy art or get people to do art, because by the time I'm done, I don't want to do art. My brain is fried. I can only concentrate on one thing, right? Okay, I'm going to do music now for a year or two. I'm going to do writing again for a year or two. I'm really going to get into filmmaking and art again for a year or two. It's really hard to balance all that out creatively. Like, my brain can only handle so much. So that's why I take time, because right now I'm concentrating on music, and I have been for just over a year. And I'll write a poem, or I'll write a blast of poems or stories, and then I'll be like, yeah, and then I'll get back and I'll start singing and playing guitar, which is, to me right now, it's really cathartic and rewarding. I'm really enjoying it. And like, I got over the fear of my voice, and it's getting better and people are digging it. And I just got asked by a dude from Montreal on Instagram. He's one of the guys that follows me. He's like, hey man, really like what you're doing now with Horse Funeral. He's like, would you be interested in singing a song on a track for me and my band? And I'm like, fuck yeah. So he sent me the recording last night, and it's kind of like post-industrial, like Nine Inch Nails kind of style, heavy. And he's like, out of the blue, man. He just sent that to me like Saturday. He's like, out of the blue. So I'm going to probably record the vocals. I already did scratch vocals last night, just finding a melodic line and just freestyled it. And so I'm going to probably tighten it up tonight and then work on it tomorrow and send it to him. And yeah, little things are happening. Little magical things happen that give you hope and faith to like get through hell, right? Because there's always a price to pay for doing this kind of thing.
Well, I think there's a lot to speak to from what you just described there, pal. And thanks a lot for sort of giving us kind of the ongoing with your current projects. Again, like that whole, narrative sequence, those stories, I surely do hope we'll find some public home sooner than later, because quite frankly, that's something that I will appreciate the opportunity to encounter and as much as possible share out through, you know, the context of my classes and the podcast and everything else, because I just feel like, you know, independent contemporary artists just have so much to offer. And it's just kind of so easy for people to miss, you know, just some of the awesome kind of grassroots kind of level art that happens across, you know, not just literary formats and even not just music, but like whether it's painting or performance or anything. I mean, every city, every kind of town, every community has its own sort of little scene associated with it. And the players, the people who participate in that stuff, usually are involved in a bunch of it because, you know, it's kind of the same people who value one area of art are going to really tend to appreciate others as well, right? Because it's also the creative impulse, right, in various ways manifested. So I really like your a collaborative notion here when you're sort of, again, to describing to people who don't know how books come together, the fact that you are speaking to, you know, what that process even actually is, right? The fact that so many people have a hand in the finished product, that whether it's a year or longer, it's because so many people have a fucking stake in the thing, right? Is that kind of the case? I mean, with your various, and again, folks, to be clear, the poetry book in question, which I obtained immediately and in a cash transaction at the 7-Eleven Lowe's Alley, was the book of Shikwemeq language poetry, right? Yeah. With some beautiful visuals placed into it. And again, I just wonder, you know, like for me, I mean, I don't have that language. I don't have, but I was still like, I just recognize that this is a significant cultural artifact. It's going to enrich my life just by even touching it and sort of, you know, engaging with it. And I mean, you know, like there are resources that I can, you know, get to out there now because it is the 21st century where, you know, I could sort of tap into, you know, teaching myself a bit, you know, just to kind of get at it. So, again, I just sort of think, you know, you've got such a diversity of the kinds of narrative outputs that you have out there and such, you know, a diverse way of engaging with the world through these projects. I mean, again, I guess, what would you, I guess, to say to anyone who's sort of at the outset of sort of a creative vantage point? I mean, you know, if somebody's sort of just thinking, you know, I'm sort of interested in sort of starting with these kinds of pursuits somehow. I mean, is there anything you would say to sort of motivate or sort of give sort of some guidance to that kind of, you know, hypothetical, say, 18 to early 20s kind of cohort who might be in a college class, say, checking in?
Totally.
What
I did was I didn't have a clue on how to get published. This is the 90s, early mid-90s or something, 96. Okay. I started self-publishing. And then I was trying to get grant money to self-publish. Didn't know how to write grants. I wrote terrible grants. And then this lady at First Peoples Cultural Council in Victoria, Kathy Charles Wary, she's retired now, helped me out. She's like, I'll help you write grants. I like what you're doing, and I think you need help, you know, to navigate that world. So she helped me with grants. But literarily, it hasn't changed. You know, technology's changed. Publishing houses come and go. You've got to get a track record. If you're an up-and-coming poet, author, short story writer, whatever, you need to get published in these, they're called literary magazines, Geist, the Capilano Review, Dandelion, New West Quarterly. Like, there's all these literary magazines across Canada that you got to get published in. And you need at least half a dozen before any publisher will even look at you, right? If you're, and I didn't know this, right? I finally got taught this by, I don't know, maybe a publisher told me what I had to do. And I had Cuevos, you know, I found Leonard Cohen's publisher, I found his manager, and I found his literary agent, and I sent them my books or my poetry. They sent it on to him, and so he corresponded with me for a while.
What?
Yeah, bro, I got letters from Cohen.
You buried the lead in the interview, man. Okay, I'm just going to put it out there. I don't know. This may have to make its way to the notes. Chris Bowes corresponded with Leonard Cohen because he was tenacious as a writer, tracked down the actual...
Free internet.
Tracked down the people who are associated with the writer, and through great tenacity, determination, and internal fortitude, you know, put out his best pitch in the fucking sports game or whatnot, and it ends up in the hands of the great man, right?
Yeah.
That must have been lit, man. I don't want to pick apart your personal correspondence, but that must have been really rewarding personally to reach that point.
It was crazy, man. It was within a year of trying to get published, you know. This must have been 96. You know, the internet was out, but it was hard to access, and I didn't know shit about it. So I found him the old-fashioned way, you know, scrolling through his books, his most recent books, finding who edited it, finding out who published it, finding his manager through that way, and I did it. And he gave me some advice, too. He's like, you know, don't worry too much about what others think, and always be true to yourself, and always have a good story, even if it's a poem. So he was really, I got about half a dozen letters or so from him, and then he had to go tour or something. So he just said that, and that's, I never heard from him again. But yeah, if a young and up-and-comer wants to do it, they got to get published in at least 6 to 10 literary magazines in Canada. It's easy to find them now. Just go online, type in literary magazines, Canada. And a lot of them are attached to universities, so they're kind of nonprofit, but they pay you, which is important, you know, because you got to send 6 poems and a query letter. Hey, this is me. This is what I do, blah, blah, blah. Just to introduce yourself, then your poems, 6 poems max. Don't want to overload them. They got tons, right? Think of how many they get every year. If you get lucky enough, if you're good enough to get published, they will send you a nice letter and a check. Usually 100, sometimes $200, sometimes $500. They'll send you that money and then they'll publish your stuff. That's how you get, I guess, acclaim and a reputation enough for a Canadian publisher to go, okay, they're serious, you know, because that takes a lot of effort. That's like a year of work, you know. You got to be tenacious. You can't just give up. And I never give up, and that's probably why I'm still here and still going. So that's how I get a book deal.
That is fantastic. I appreciate the practical insights. And folks, in our pre-conversation, I did not advise him specifically to hype the literary magazines whatsoever. I am going to say that I made it a point, you know, within the first couple of weeks of class, to be sure, to exactly speak to those literary publications, right? To like go to one of these lists, like curated by, you know, CBC Books or something like that, where like, you know, like they have those annual writing contests and stuff. But even more to the point, they have like, you know, here's like the 25 main kind of literary publications coming out in Canada. And I mean, again, I had a similar experience, you know, as a teenager, as a young man, just kind of, again, you sort of forget in the post-digital kind of era, like your whole correspondence with Leonard. I mean, that whole, you know, you get the physical letter, you open it up, you kind of take it out, and you get to experience that in a tangible, tactile kind of way. I mean, unless you were doing the emails with them, or what was the case there? I mean,
all letters, all... This is
that's what I mean, right? Like, I'd go to a show, I'd go to a punk gig in Bretterton, and, you know, just buy their merch or some shit, and then just, hey, by the way, your show was awesome. They get back home, they get their mail, and then they just send you some goofy, like, photograph or something back. Like,
stickers. Cool,
right? It's like, you know, the physical internet, right? Mail. Yeah. Like, the physical manifestation of the internet before there even was. You know?
Yeah, this is before I knew what the hell I was doing on the internet. And so, yeah, this is all.
You're leveraging the internet significantly with your practice as an independent artist. Do you want to speak to that aspect of it a bit, bro?
Yeah, for sure. Before I do, I just want to say most universities have subscriptions to all those literary magazines, like from across Canada. And it's also really important if you're wanting to get published, you write dark, morose poetry, you got to know your audience. So check out the books or check them out online and see what they're writing. You know, there's a great one in Vancouver called Subterrain. They do really dark stuff. I love them. They've published me a few times in the past. And so it's really important to know your audience, you know.
Yes.
I write crazy, heavy, insane stuff, but also funny stuff. So I get the weirdest walks of life that like my books. It's so crazy. Anyways, so the video and the internet stuff, around 2000, I started to wrap my head around the internet and got an email, Angel Fire. Oh, my God, that's so old. And then
yourself, my friend. That's true.
I would go to TRU, the local uni. And I wasn't a student at the time, but I just went. And the computers back then didn't have passwords. You just go in, click on it. And I would dumpster dive in. I really liked the biology and the sciences building because they only did. They did both sides, but sometimes they only did one side. And they always had the weirdest stuff, like all the research they were doing. And so I dumpster dive and I'd steal a stack of like thousands of pages of paper, recycle it, and print out 20 pages of my manuscripts.
Wow.
And I'd send them.
Bro,
I had a teacher. What was his name? Alec. Old guy. He really liked my work. And he's like, just put all the envelopes outside my door and I'll mail them out for you. Because I had no money, right? I'm so fucking poor. This is 2000.
Dude.
And so he.
Diving for the paper stock is like. That should be on your literary bio, man. I mean, I'd be going to conferences on that shit.
I'd crank it out, the printing at the uni. Yeah. I'd be there all night, man. I'd sit there and I'd do research on publishing houses. I would go and I was so hungry, man. I had nothing else. It was my goal to get published. It took 3 years, 7 years. But, you know, it was worth it because, man, I've seen the world and it's been pretty fun. But that university professor, I'd leave fucking stacks, man, 20, 30 stacks, you know, 20, 30 pages each envelope, big yellow manila envelopes. He's like, I'll mail them. I'll use my expense account. And he did, man. He helped me, too, like, get out
there. That's part of an enlightened cultural mandate, I got to say.
Yeah, it was cool.
Working in concert with, you know, individuals who have an opportunity to pass something through relative to their sphere of influence. And, you know, this is where I've been trying to share with people, like, the collective endeavor of publishing and writing is such that, you know, the book that comes out or the poem that's in the book, I mean, it's just the tip of the iceberg, you know, it's all this cultural activity that led to it being there in the first place. There's all this, you know, cultural context that exists around it that even determines that it is a work of art as opposed to, say, some other kind of, you know, piece of communication. So, I mean, everything you're sort of talking about, like the people who sort of feed into your life and sort of make their way through it and that ultimately give you kind of further impetus to move the thing forward in whatever way, man. Everything you're touching there really seems pretty legit and interesting, I gotta say, my friend.
Thanks, man. What's funny is, like, okay, I think I dumpster dive in the literature arts building at TRU, and I came across this indigenous poet who lived in Washington State. Her name was Christos. I don't even know if she's alive anymore. But it was really powerful. Her poetry, she was indigenous. I don't know where she was from. I can't remember. Really powerful. And years later, man, I met her at a friggin' conference, some literary thing, like 4 or 5 years later, somewhere, I think in Toronto or something. She was on the same bill.
Awesome.
So I was like, oh my God. So I told her this story.
Such a formative influence on me from such a sort of, from such inauspicious beginnings, as it were, right?
Yeah, it was
come a long way, you know, from the dumpster to the conference in Tirana. Yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy. I was like, holy shit. And she was like, what? That's crazy, man. And here we are. And I'm like, yeah, here we are. Holy shit. That was like a pretty starstruck moment for me. I was like, wow, this is just fucking unreal that it would happen, right? Just the way the planets align.
Well, again, it's just sort of like if you sort of pursue, this is why I feel like people who are in the narrative business kind of get to have like this sort of extra life, you know? It's sort of like you got your regular sort of day to day, which, you know, everybody seems to kind of manage. But then, you know, you sort of start looking purposefully at story as something that you're engaging with, as somebody who sort of creates the thing in a certain way. But then also because you're creating it, you're being shaped by that process of creation. And so you just kind of end up vectoring off into, you know, the orbit of similarly oriented individuals. And again, as you say, you know, those moments of confluence, if you will, or synchronicity, to paraphrase the English rock band of a certain era, you know, it's cool, you know, when you sort of get further down your path in years where you can have those moments, right, where you've been intentional about setting yourself up to be in creative situations to the point that that kind of stuff kind of gets a chance to manifest you know. I mean, if that shit doesn't sound too flaky, you know, I guess.
No, that's it. That's it. Like, COVID really screwed everything up. Like, I lost a lot of momentum in my so-called careers.
Yeah.
Art and film and music. And I was booking a tour. I had a band. We were rehearsing in Vancouver. We were booking festivals. We were kind of like an art house noise project. And I was reciting poetry and singing and just, it was really crazy chaotic, but fun and really cool. I should find some of that and send it to you. And
I love it, man. Definitely on a personal level and on the punk music show, where we could do this whole parallel thing about the current state of the horse funeral and the current state of, you know, I dare say, heavy music generally, and I would even pick Chris's mind and experience for contemporary, current indigenous, you know, art or punk kind of artists. But, you know, in the interests of our potential slightly more, college-bound, you know, thing, I can say, you got to get to campus, but then you also kind of got to explore the other areas of life a little bit beyond the campus. In order to make sure that you kind of have something to even, you know, feed the overall endeavor. So, you know, going into a bar in another neighborhood or going to a coffee shop on the other side of town or just anything to get outside of your comfort zone. You get a habit of going outside your comfort zone, I think you can find a lot, you know, that you just get to get offered because you're putting yourself at risk a little bit. So I guess
Do spoken word. Go read poetry at a coffee house. Go to a jam night and get up on guitar or drums or whatever and suck. You always suck at the beginning, but
it's awesome to suck.
Yeah, it's great.
Awesome
you don't need
to suck
just,
at heart.
That's how you learn. You know, I used to be a really shy kid, man, like grade 8, grade 9. God.
Brutal years for a sense
couldn't
of
handle, yeah. Now I basically get paid to talk for a living, you know, and tell stories and make music. And it's hard to believe sometimes. And I still, you know, I'll work with people. You know, they're instructors or they're leaders or something, and they're just so terrible at public speaking. It's like, wow, you got to get over that. You just got to do it. And I've been performing for, I don't know, Jesus, almost 30 years. 30 years, I bet I've been on stages. So it's like breathing to me. I have no problem. You know, 10,000 people, fuck, no problem. You know, 1,000, no problem. 10, no problem. You just got to get comfortable, get out of your comfort zone and give her, you know what I mean?
Engaging with any kind of public through any kind of art is a privilege. That's how I look at it. You get to spend a day, you know, kind of moving the envelope forward with your creative endeavor in a way that sort of helps move you as a human and makes you feel more integrated and with the flow of nature as a human. Any kind of day you can have that where you're doing that with something you care about, preferably, you know, that's what I go to art for personally, but other people got different ways, right? I'm not going to diminish that. But we are here for literary chat and an artistic chat, so us two are of that kind of mentality, I suppose.
Yeah.
In terms of writers or artists generally, man, I mean, if I were just to say, you know, over the past little while, you know, authors, filmmakers, storytellers, musicians, I mean, if you were just to name sort of a few of your kind of interests generally going on right now within the wider culture, you know, indigenous or otherwise, I mean, what's kind of grabbing your attention lately? Folks, I follow his Instagram, and he and I throw all kinds of ridiculous things at each other on a daily basis through the Instagram. You can speak to some of that if you care to, or, you know, otherwise, man. I'm just we're at the tail end here. I think it's time to wind down.
Yeah.
But if there's any current, you know, musicians, authors, or anybody you'd care to point out or kind of shout out has kind of been doing some good things right now, I'd be interested to hear, bro.
Cormac McCarthy, I'm kind of on another burn with that author. I really like his straightforward storytelling style.
How do you feel about Blood Meridian, man, as an indigenous person? Sorry to ask, but I have to ask, since you mentioned
it. It's a tough one, right?
Yeah,
a lot of the stuff is centered in the West, but I read it to get that perspective. That's why I read it. I'm like, well, I'm indigenous. I want to hear what the old settlers and, you know, people.
It's an existential kind of masterwork, right? That kind of.
Yeah.
It defies the ability to point to any side. It's like literally not only is there beyond good and evil, it's like the universe is actively looking to destroy you at every opportunity. And it's definitely that kind of thing that Cormac, I love Cormac, man. So you name that and I can just, you know, go off and it'll lose the semblance of any kind of interview. So Cormac for sure. Who else you got, bro?
I'm reading, I'm reading a lot of nonfiction right now.
Awesome.
I just read a book by Mark Lanegan. He's also one of my favorite musicians. He passed a couple years ago, which is really sad.
Yeah.
But, I'm reading, his stuff. I'm reading a book about Johnny Cash. I'm also reading a lot of history stuff. I always kind of go back to the greats, you know, William S. Burroughs, Leonard Cohen, you know, indigenous authors. You know, I'll read some of Gary's stuff, but he just cranks out so much, it's hard to keep up.
It's true. And then
Richard Van Camp. And then I kind of dig around and see what else I can find for up and coming. History stuff. I've been reading a lot about the history of BC because I want to know how our land was stolen. So I'm reading a bunch of BC history stuff, the gold rush and all that kind of stuff. Anything from the film company A24 is usually pretty good.
100%.
I really dig what they crank out. Hereditary is one of my all-time favorite movies.
That's brutal.
I like Midsommar, but there's so much crying in it. Oh, my God, that chick just cries through the whole goddamn movie. It's like, really? You're gonna cry again? Like, oh, my
so,
God.
So to the individual here who has spoken earlier in the discussion as, you know, having a series of indigenous horror comedy, I'm of the opinion personally that the horror genre as a whole is really conducive to, it's really artist friendly. It's really like you can just by the definition of the genre throw extremity into it and have that navigating the extremity as sort of an extension of like the thing. And it's just like, you know, it gives you a chance to be funny and ironic and shocking in ways that are like the tropes of the genre are helpful to that purpose, right? So that's why like Edgar Allan Poe and Stephen King and people like that are just, we're going to be talking about those motherfuckers forever. I mean, pardon me.
Oh, yeah.
Me, right? So.
And like, I was in Vancouver in August for like a week or so, and I went to the library and I got a Vancouver Public Library card. So I took out like 10 books maximum, right?
Yeah.
All Indigenous. I'll have to get you the titles.
Awesome.
Authors and graphic novels. And then I've also been reading a lot about my favorite artist, Hieronymus Bosch.
Awesome.
So reading a book about him from 2016.
Okay.
That came out. It's a big book. And I saw it in Montreal around that time when I was on tour. And I wanted to buy it. It was like $250. And it was huge.
And so it's like with the illustrations and everything in it. Is it?
Yeah, cool. It's really good. But I had a flight and I couldn't. It weighed a ton, right? It was hardcover. And so I didn't buy it. And I always buy books when I go to Montreal. Like there's a few comic stores and a few bookstores. God, I hope they're still there that I always go to. And cause Kamloops being the cultural wellspring it is, you can't really find a lot of stuff here. So I always Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal and Vancouver to a lesser extent.
Definitely to a lesser extent.
Would go buy books in the '80s, man. Vancouver had tons of bookstores. Fuck, it's unreal. Everything's just become this homogenized modern glass city, right? We're an international city. No, it just means you're boring and bland like every other.
It means that nobody can afford to live there except the rich and the people who work for the rich.
Exactly.
If you want to get on the property ladder, if you want to have any kind of like, you know, just normal middle class, you know, approximating kind of experience. You got to be in you can't do it. You got to be in the lower mainland. You got to deal with commutes that are brutal. I just say people like avoid the mainland from a living standpoint. Nice to visit, but I literally cannot fathom how people manage to carve out a living. You know, I found interior BC, you know, I found Shuswap at Okanagan, you know, like I could kind of handle that, but jeepers creepers, man.
It's tough.
Well, we're hitting the hour.
Let me say a couple things. For music, Mark Lanegan, Tom Waits, Caius, Nick Cave, Bjork. Who else? God, there's so many good bands. Nine Inch Nails, I'm really listening to The Fragile right now. It's really inspiring me. A lot of great music. Films by A24. I'm a horror movie fanatic, so I've got hundreds of horror movies that I watch. I was watching Halloween, the one by Rob Zombie, just before I got a hold of you. And,
awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, if people want to reach out and ask me more questions, go to my website, go to my contact page and fire me an email, or go to my Facebook, Chris Mo's Artist.
Yeah.
And you can reach me there as well. My personal Facebook is closed. It's only 300 people, and they're people I know and I see on a semi-regular basis, so don't message me there. I'll hate it. But yeah, Chris Mo's Artist on Facebook or my website, you can reach out to me. If you have any questions, you know, don't be scared. You know, I'm really easy to reach out to you, and I respond pretty quick.
Well, yeah. And I just have to say again, just having, you know, somebody who can sort of stand in and kind of speak from a Canadian standpoint about practicing in a variety of outputs, you know, various, you know, formats and such across multiple decades, you know, multiple areas of endeavor, you know, traveled around the world as you have with your music and other cultural endeavors. I mean, really, it's kind of easy to lose track sometimes about how much, you know, one individual can do and accomplish across these areas. I mean, this is ostensibly for, you know, the literature class at the college, but I mean, there's so much other extra literary material that sort of is in and of the wider engagement with a human being, right? And I just think that, you know, the fact that you're involved in so much of this work, Chris, and that you are just so open and forthright about wanting to engage with people, whether it's through social media or in other ways. I mean, to me, that's just like, this person is putting in the work. This person is engaging with their audience and potential audience and anybody who's interested, because, you know, that's what it's about. It's about kind of finding a space to share with other people, I think, at the end of the day, in some capacity, right?
Totally. Yeah, literature, man, took me around the world. You know, my first book tour, I think, was 21 readings in 23 days, and I think I had 24 flights. You know, it was crazy. So, yeah, literature changed my life, man. So if people want to do it, it's still doable to this day. It just takes time.
Very much so.
Just takes time and dedication, man. All right.
Time in the chair. So anything else you want to shout out here on the end down here, bro?
No, I think that's about it. If people have questions or whatever, they can get a hold of me. And I've got books. I've got In Shaken, copies of that for sale. I got my newest book for sale, Crazy Coyote Forever. I've got a couple copies of A Moon Made of Copper still. So I've got books. If people want to buy actual physical books, they can do that. I do digital sales too. So if people want PDF versions of my books, I can send those. If they want to check out my art or anything, my music, you know, you have all the links. You can share it with the people. And yeah, just keep rocking, man. I really appreciate what you do. And I appreciate you wanting to take time and talk to me. And hear me out a bit and let me share my story. I appreciate it.
Man, I have enjoyed this a lot. I knew I was going to. I'm glad that I did. I'm glad that we have. Folks, I'm going to end the recording now. Take care, everybody. Catch you later. Catch you on the other side, as it were. Bye for now.